Hello, everyone. Welcome to Executive Report. Today, we have Rob Weinholt, the author of The Art of Crisis Leadership, as well as a very distinguished CEO. So before we get started, let me read a quick bio so you know who we're talking to. So Rob Weinholt is the chief executive of Falston Group, a Baltimore-based executive advisory firm designed to help organizations build, strengthen, and defend their reputations, something a lot of organizations need these days. You know, Rob has worked on the core executive leadership team at all three levels of government and privately on Major League Baseball's Hall of Famer Cal Ripken Jr.'s core executive team in Baltimore. During his public service career, Rob most notably served in a sworn capacity for the Baltimore Police Department and was ultimately promoted through the ranks to public affairs director. He's also served as chief of staff for the United States Department of Justice and senior executive within Maryland Governor's Office. Rob also authored the nationally published book titled The Art of Crisis Leadership. The book quickly rose to Amazon's number one release in both the public relations and crisis management categories, while cracking the top 100 in the prestigious leadership category. Rob was named a 2017 Most Admired CEO by the Daily Record. From large public companies to healthcare systems to hospitality groups to individuals, Rob's work has spanned across many industries and geographies. So, Rob, welcome to Executive Reports.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here this morning.
Absolutely. So, I have to tell you, I started looking back of how long we've known each other, and I realized it's coming up on a decade. Mm. You know, I have a hard time even, you know, quantifying that. Mm-hmm. You know, the time just slips by. But something that I've known since I first met you is you are extraordinarily knowledgeable in the area of crisis, crisis management, crisis leadership. And, you know, I think that that's something that is a huge emphasis today, both for businesses as well as individuals. I mean, let's face it, the world is not short on crisis. There's plenty out there. But it is lacking the ability to lead or possibly even grow through crisis. So, you know, we'll get to a lot of that in a minute. But in the meantime, I'm thinking about crisis leadership, and I don't remember seeing a course in college about it. In fact, I don't even remember being offered a career path specific to crisis management. So how did you get involved in this stuff?
Well, it's kind of funny. If you look today, there's a lot of courses, crisis management, crisis leadership, resiliency, risk management, because, you know, we always say it's not a matter of if crisis will occur, but a matter of when. And let's face it, I mean, who can't lead when profits are up, morale is high, the sun is shining? I think the real test of the mettle of a leader is during a time of sensitivity, adversity, or crisis. And there's a lot of resources out there. There's a lot of people who've been through a lot of turbulent times in their lives. And so I'd encourage your listeners to learn from them, ask them questions, because my experience is that people want to talk about some of the difficult times they've been through because, number one, it's cathartic. And number two, they have a lot of lessons that are really important to help those around them.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I imagine that with your time with the police department and DOJ, you know, you got the chance to experience both good and bad versions of leadership. I mean, those are really politically charged environments with, you know, a lot of underlying motives. I mean, what are some of the things you remember from those times?
Well, it's kind of interesting. As I was on my way here, I started to think about this question of crisis management. And, you know, I started my career in the Baltimore Police Department, so I ran around and played cops and robbers, you know, when I was 30 pounds lighter, had more hair, and my 40 time was a little quicker back then, by the way. But as I thought about all the situations I've been in, the police department was a really, really good training ground in that I saw the very worst of humanity and the very best of humanity. And it taught me how to lead and remain, you know, more of the calming presence in an otherwise turbulent time and really help people during their most difficult time. And so ultimately, you know, being promoted, working at the local, state, federal levels of government or even in the private sector, it really is about, you know, how do you see the whole room? How do you analyze all the nuances? How do you understand the facts so that ultimately you can provide the right counsel so the advice you give today is still the right advice 100 steps downstream. But I just want to say I've got a tremendous amount of respect for the men and women in law enforcement. They have such a difficult time. And what I always say about those heroes who walk the street every day is, you know, these are ordinary men and women thrust into extraordinary circumstances on a routine basis. And you learn an awful lot about yourself and the world around you during those times on the street.
Yeah. Was there any one person that really stood out to you as an exceptional leader at DOJ or at the police department?
Absolutely. I mean, there was one individual that that I know and I'm friends with today, and he was a person who was very approachable. He was very knowledgeable. But most importantly, he had a trait that I think the most exceptional leaders in the world have, and that is he was empathetic. He took the time, he was engaged, he understood, and he had the ability to put himself in your shoes and not just understand what you thought, but how you felt. And so, again, from my standpoint, great leaders do five things really well. They teach, they communicate, they motivate, they empower, and they hold people accountable. Yeah. And if you can master those five skills, I think you'll be doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, it's interesting. The last one on your list is holding people accountable. And I think a lot of leaders start with that.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can create a little bit of a toxic environment if you don't have the other skill sets. So.
Yeah, that old adage, right? People don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. And people need to understand that you're vested in them and the rest will follow.
Absolutely.
But yeah, really important model that, frankly, I was talking to Art Modell about at the Baltimore Ravens 20 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
That's impressive. Mm-hmm. So you got through the police department, you got through the DOJ, and then you made this transition into the private sector, really. And you started working with Cal Ripken Jr. And all the wonderful things he was doing. I'm curious, why did you decide to make that transfer? I mean, did the politics, you know, just get to be too much?
No, it wasn't the politics. I've always been a pretty curious person, and I love to learn. And I always felt like, you know, my time in Baltimore was just amazing, and I learned a tremendous amount. But then I had the opportunity to go to the Department of Justice as chief of staff and learn about national policymaking, how to lead people, how to make sure we were solving problems in communities. And so I think just being wired as a naturally curious person who wants to learn, who wants to do new things. One thing I found that even in government, I feel like I've always been an entrepreneurial person. You know, how can we do something bigger, faster, stronger? And eventually just had a desire to open up my own business. And so the timing was right to make the leap to the private sector. And I got to tell you, my time with Cal and Bill was so rewarding. I learned so much. There was a wonderful organization, and I couldn't be more grateful for those experiences.
Got it. Now, when you were there, were you working with them in this area of crisis leadership or something else?
No, when I was there, I ran their core business, meaning their amateur baseball business. And so I had an opportunity to grow their camps, their tournaments, build a complex in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and grow the team and eventually, you know, grow the brand along the way. But, you know, they were very empowering, and I can't say enough really positive things about that experience, because from a business standpoint, I learned a lot about leadership and about people in the public sector. And in the private sector, those skills were translatable. Hmm. But I learned a lot about some of the skill sets you wouldn't get in government, like sales, like marketing, right?
Yeah.
And how to go out and make sure that you can grow a business and understand what the important elements of a P&L are, or a balance sheet, or those types of things. Yeah, we went and got funding from Congress, but you had to make it, and you were up and down the street every day when you're in a small business trying to get to the next level. So those two broad experiential skill sets eventually gave me the courage, frankly, to start my own business. And you know, I very much rely on those experiences today.
Excellent. Honestly, I think the government should pay a little more attention to the P&L.
Great point. Great point. We talk so much about budget.
Yeah,
let's pay attention to it.
But with that aside point, you had said something that I fully agree a little bit ago. You said it's not if crisis will happen, it's when. And we know that crisis can happen in a lot of different ways. It can happen personally, financially, socially, operationally, you know, all those different things. But the thing that really, I guess you say, grabbed my attention is the ability to take that adversity and turn it into something positive. How do you do that? Especially in specific cases where, I mean, people might be going to prison, bankruptcies, all kinds of different things, but somehow you're able to turn that adversity into an advantage.
Yeah, it's interesting. I always say that crisis is a growth strategy, and that's counterintuitive for a lot of people. They're like, well, wait a minute, we don't want crisis. I said, well, in some ways you do, because you have an opportunity to test your leadership skills. You have an opportunity to shine in the moment and really, you know, create positive change, you know, in the right directions. You know, I always say that crises cost time, money, customers, careers, your freedom, and in the worst case of scenarios, lives. So the stakes are very high. And it really comes down to the old adage you would hear, you know, I did as a young boy, you know, it's not what happened, it's kind of how you handle it. You know, what are you doing about the situation? And so some people are thrust in the crisis because it's their own doing. Others are just a victim of circumstances. But you have an opportunity to decision make and act with integrity and decisiveness and a level of optimism and create positive change during otherwise turbulent times. And so what I try to do with people is say, listen, when we cycle through this moment in time, whether it's a week, whether it's a month, whether it's a year, what do you want your world, your life personally and professionally to look like when we get through this? Because I know what your navigational fix is. We're going to weather the storm now that we understand your goals. There's about 5 to 10 ways to solve every single problem. Let's pick the best one for you so that you're right side up on the back end of this.
So how do you plan for that? Like, obviously, there's a proactive plan in place, but you really don't know what the crisis could be. So is it just generalized, or is it more specific?
Well, there's not always a proactive plan in place. And by the way, you know the old adage, right? Everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth, right?
That's right.
So, you know, what you can do from a business standpoint, we do something called a crisis assessment. So we'll go in and we'll speak to leadership teams individually. And I say, listen, at the end of the fiscal year, and you're charged with hitting certain goals, certain metrics, the KPIs, whatever they happen to be, what could prevent you from achieving those goals? And it's amazing when people start to think about the various internal and external factors that could prevent the organization from growth. We start to brainstorm and say, okay, these are things that could happen in this organization. Then we do industry research and say, this is what has happened to others in your market space. Let's plan. So if these top five, let's say, things happen that we've identified, what's the playbook? You know, how do we lead? How do we strategize? How do we decision make? Who has responsibility? What roles are you playing? And ultimately, how do we communicate it? And so what we do when we work with organizations is try to create something we call organizational muscle memory, so that when a triggering event occurs, you know exactly what to do and how to handle it, because you will be bigger, faster, stronger after than you were before if you go ahead and plan ahead of time. And I always say, and I think it's very important, it really is about marketplace trust. Mm-hmm. And so you want to make sure that you're filling your reputational piggy bank every day along the way, because you know as an organization, as a leader, you're going to make withdrawals. You just don't want to end up with a zero balance.
Got it. So for all you guys out there in YouTube world, remember that reputational piggy bank. I think that's really important.
And I'll just say very quickly is that reputation leads to trust, and trust leads to valuation. Your reputation, Steve, leads to trust, which then leads to your organization's valuation. And keep this in mind, not all currency is financial.
Ah, that's brilliant. You're right. When you think of why people do business with you, most of the time it's not because of financial reasons. Mm-hmm. So that's great points, all great points. So when I read your book, I noticed that you talked about really five motivations of why, you know, good people might do bad things, or even you could call them bad people doing bad things. And I was really curious about them. So could you educate us a little bit on that?
Money, power, sex, and revenge.
Money, power, sex, and revenge. Okay.
And that's four, but we can make it five.
Okay.
Right? So money stands, on its own, right? People are driven by that. Power. You could say power and control. So money, power, control, sex, and revenge. Yep. And you think about why people do bad things, and you take a look at many case studies, or frankly, what's happening in the news cycle today, and you say, well, what motivates that person to do something like that? And kind of like in the old pachinko board fashion, you land on these different primal drivers that really seem to be sometimes embedded in someone's DNA, and that's what motivates them. And by the way, you know, some of the people that are really dangerous are the ones that are hitting on many of the cylinders, not just one. They might be driven by money, but there's revenge in there. And then you got this power and control, and you got ego creeping in. And so when we work with clients, I very much try to understand the individual and what's driving them. And once I'm able to understand as best I can someone's heart and what's driving them, it gives me a pretty good sense of how to manage a situation in the individual, because inevitably it's absolutely not just professional, it's personal as well.
Yeah. So I'm curious, when you're meeting someone, do you have like those things rolling in the back of your mind while you're talking to them?
100%. Rolling in the back of my mind now? No, I'm just kidding.
I can appreciate that. So as leaders, people that are hiring employees, you know, doing interviews, are those things that leaders and employers should be thinking about while they're working with other people?
Absolutely. In fact, when I speak to audiences, whether it's a keynote or something else, I talk about these primal drivers, and then I ask people to go ahead and evaluate who they have around them, who they trust in their professional worlds, and then I say, well, let's take it a step further. Who are you around personally, right? And it doesn't mean that you have to be suspicious of or distrust the people around you. It does mean that if you have a better understanding of what makes them tick and motivates them, then you might say, okay, well, you know what? This really drives a person. Maybe they're better slotted over here in the company. Or you know what? I'll just say, at my age right now, at this point in my life, and I've done a lot of introspection, and there's really only two kinds of people in this world for me at this point: those who give me energy and those who take it away. And then I really challenge the people I work with, and just some people I interact with, or those who might have a conversation, because I've been challenged a lot too, to take a hard look in the mirror. But I say, look in the mirror. Which one are you? Are you the person that pops people full of sunshine and makes them feel good and motivates them and empowers them? Or are you a drag on the bottom line, and maybe you're the bottleneck? And that's a hard thing to do. But I think if we're honest with ourselves and we can be a little bit vulnerable and evaluate our own egos, I think we go a lot further in life. But I can say that now at my age. I wouldn't have known that 20 years ago.
So that brings an interesting point, right?
Yeah.
Let's say we do look in the mirror. And I'll use myself as an example. Let's say I look in the mirror and I do come to that realization that I'm dragging everything down. Maybe I'm the bottleneck. How do you overcome that?
It's interesting, because it's the same thing as if you're facing some kind of challenge. And this is a challenge, right? Because your own ego or the way you do things may be holding you and other people back. But it's really two things. Number one, put your hand up and say, you know what? This is an issue for me. Great. Our egos won't allow us to go out there and say, you know what? I got a problem, and here it is.
Yep.
But put your hand up and say, you know, I've got a challenge here and I've got to work on it. The second thing is to reach out to those you trust. Be vulnerable, explain the problem, and see what their take is. They may not be seeing what you see or feel, or they might be seeing something else. And this concept, by the way, while it sounds very 101-ish, is the same barometer I use when I meet someone for the first time and they start to tell me about, you know, their crisis or the situation that they're in or about to be in. I have found that the people that cycle through crisis the quickest and get right side up and are generally bigger, faster, stronger after the defining moment than they were before are the people who do those two things. They understand that they're losing control. They understand that they need help and they're in trouble. And they also reach out to their trusted network for perspective. Very, very important. And by the way, there's a lot of reasons people don't do that. We talked about ego, but they may be embarrassed. They may hope that the pain goes away tomorrow. They may not know what to do about it, but they're usually good at figuring things out. But when you're in the bullseye, it's really hard to do that. So again, hey, put your hand up. I've got a problem here. And number two, reach out to those you trust, because they will have an opinion. And by the way, they're glad to help if you let them in the door.
Yeah, that's true. It's amazing how often people are willing to help.
Yeah.
But someone has to make the first step.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've been talking about crisis really from this perspective of corporate or even, you know, the idea of running a group of people in a leadership role. But I think oftentimes, and you might even be able to make an argument, that crisis happens more on a personal level more often than on a professional level. You know, just recently, you can look at the Will Smith incident. Martha Stewart heart had a huge problem that she was able to overcome and actually, you know, become better as a result of it. So if there's someone out there that has a sense of celebrity or a really personalized brand like some of these athletes, what advice would you give people like that to how to prepare for a potential crisis?
Yeah, I mean, you brought it up. Tiger, Toyota, Martha Stewart, Goldman Sachs, Penn State, BP, Ray Rice, the NFL, United Airlines, Uber. We could go on and on and on and list brands and individuals as long as the day is, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the day, you're still dealing with people, right? You have a brand, right, and a brand value, a Q rating or whatever it is that applies to you that's very, very important. And you brought up Will Smith, right? A lot of opinions about Will Smith,
yep.
You know, but at the end of the day, you got Will Smith, the individual, Will Smith, the property, and then of course the business interests and the whole nine yards.
Yep.
And I think what needs to generally occur with people in a high profile position is to realize that because you're high profile, right, people will talk about you and they will have an opinion. So in many ways, you're immediately in the court of public opinion, whether you want to be or not. Therefore, what you say matters. Mm-hmm. And to me, you've got to get to the heart. You've got to get to the root cause. You have to have command of the facts. You have to understand what the eventuality is, you know, in terms of where you want to be personally and where you want to be professionally, because crisis can be, again, a growth strategy if handled correctly. Mm-hmm. And take it out of Will Smith or anybody else that, you know, might be in the court of public opinion. Isn't it? There's something called the 15-70-15 paradigm, which I think is really important. And it goes like this. 15% of the people, you know, you could go up and hand them a winning lottery ticket or give them a bar of gold, and it doesn't matter. Whatever you do, they're not going to like you or your position.
Yeah.
The other 15%, right, the bottom line is no matter what you do, they're going to love you. So at the end of the day, you're really fighting for that 70% in between. So something really awkward or unusual happens that is generally against someone's character. When you think about analyzing the situation, you're going to have a percentage that will never like you. You're going to have a percentage that will always love you, right? If you punch them in the nose, it would be the best punch in the nose they ever received. But there's a lot of people in between that are going to take a step back, raise their eyebrow and say, wow, that's really unusual. I want to see what else happens. Mm-hmm. And that's your leadership opportunity right there.
Got it. Well, I think we got a lot of golden nuggets out of this 20 minutes. I mean, reputational piggy bank, organizational muscle memory.
There you go.
What was the other one? Not all currency is financial.
Right,
so,
right.
For everyone listening, make sure you hit the like button. Make sure you subscribe and share the video. Rob, this is a great book, The Art of Crisis Leadership. If someone wants to purchase it, where can they do that?
Well, you can just go to Amazon, right, mm-hmm. and look it up, and there it is, and have fun. It's a book that'll, if you have trouble sleeping, it'll put you to sleep really quick. So,
gotcha. Well, thank you so much for coming today. I hope to have you again soon.
Okay, thank you so much. I've enjoyed our time together.